Evolution can be defined as changes in allele frequencies as a function of time. Though we can spend a lot of time considering changes in allele frequencies, in this lecture what we're going to consider instead is time. Basically, the technical means by which one can passage organisms through time and so that they in fact can evolve in some manner, and also various theory that's associated with that passage and also consequences that can result from this passage. This is the underlying basis of what experimental microbial population biology or experimental microbial evolution is all about. So right now, first, we're going to be studying in this chapter passage through time, or passage of microorganisms through time. So experimental evolution is a lot of what we're going to be talking about in this lecture. So for a variety of reasons, researchers have developed means by which microorganisms may be propagated in ways that tend to allow them to evolve. Of course, we also have means of storing organisms so that they minimize or display a minimal amount of evolution. But if you're doing experimental evolution studies, the key is that you want these organisms to evolve. It's also important to keep in mind that there are practical reasons for evolving organisms. One way of evolving new properties into organisms is by letting them grow in a given environment under a given set of conditions so that they evolve or either evolve new properties or improve upon existing properties. And these properties can be useful to us, such as increased production of secondary metabolites that we can use, for example, as solvents or vitamins or what have you. So often the evolution that occurs in the course of these experimental evolution studies is adaptation. You put an organism into an environment that's at least a little bit novel to that organism, and the organism will tend to adapt to that environment. This includes even if you take an organism that is being grown, for example, in broth culture. That broth culture is not the environment that this organism evolved in. Even if it's been propagated in the laboratory for long periods of time. And as a consequence, evolution adaptation should occur even given passage through time in something as mundane as broth culture. It's also possible to passage organisms when their population sizes are quite small. And when you do this, what you're doing is you're making sure that the organisms basically are bottlenecked, and that promotes genetic drift. And with genetic drift, of course, you end up with non-adaptive evolution. It's also possible to involve migration in experimental evolution studies, but that generally is not what is done. It can be relatively complicated to have migration going on during your experimental evolution studies. On the other hand, migration is a very important aspect of evolution as it occurs in the wild, and so by not including migration in experimental evolution studies, a lot of what can actually occur in the wild can be missed. Organisms can adapt to situations in the wild that they might not be able to adapt to in the laboratory simply because migration, that is horizontal gene transfer, can be such an important component of the evolution of microorganisms in the environment. So there are two basic approaches to propagating microorganisms in the laboratory. These are serial transfer or serial passage. You can use these words interchangeably. Alternatively, serial transfer might be what you use to describe the propagation of organisms over time in the laboratory, and serial passage perhaps in given propagation of, say, viruses in animals passaging from one animal to another. But these two phrases are to a large degree interchangeable. And then the other is continuous culture. There are a number of different ways of effecting continuous culture, but the most common one is the use of something known as a chemostat. And we'll be spending quite a bit of time this lecture talking about chemostats. So continuous culture, it provides a more hands-off experience. So you can set up these cultures and let them run basically on automatic pilot over long periods of time. And this makes these experiments relatively easy to do once you've set things up. On the other hand, they tend to be relatively complicated to set up. With serial passage, you can typically control experiments to a greater degree. That is the details of how the experiment progresses. It's also much more easy to use serial passage or serial transfer type experiments when you're working with something that involves spatial structure. The basic idea of a chemostat is that it's lacking in spatial structure. That is, that it's a well-stirred, well-mixed environment. But when you're transferring, for example, off of plates or transferring from one animal to another, it can be much more difficult to do that using a continuous culture approach, and as a consequence, serial passage is employed instead. And this is just another example of how it can be easier to manipulate the details of experimental passage using serial transfer or serial passage versus a continuous culture. Though simple in principle, the experimental evolution schemes nonetheless can have complex outcomes. So you can set things up and you can start a population going, but it typically will be difficult, except in broad outline, to predict what is going to happen evolutionarily in that culture. So this is just a standard bacterial growth curve. So you've got lag phase, where organisms are gearing up for their growth, log phase, where basically organisms are dividing more or less at a constant rate, stationary phase, which can mean more than one thing depending upon circumstances. It either can be the cessation of organism replication, or instead it can mean a balance between organism growth and organism death. If you leave organisms in a stationary phase where they're not growing for long enough, eventually they'll start dying off. And that dying off might end at the point where you've got certain organisms that actually are able to continue to propagate at a low rate in these otherwise somewhat spent cultures. Now, with serial transfer, of bacteria, you're going to start the transfer at some point in here, and you're going to end it at some point in here. So, for example, you might start the culture in lag phase, starting with, say, stationary phase organisms, let them proceed through log phase, and then finish the transfer with stationary phase. So, in other words, the next transfer will come out of stationary phase, go into fresh broth, initiating lag phase, etc. That approach is convenient because you can set up your experiments so that they last, say, a day, and as a consequence, the organisms are going to pass through all of this, and then they just kind of sit there in stationary phase, waiting for you to come around the next day and do the transfer to lag phase and continue the process. Alternatively, in a chemostat, what you see is a stationary phase that doesn't involve the cessation of organism growth, but instead the ongoing growth of the organism in a steady state, where the increase in organism number is balanced by removal of organisms from the environment. And this results in a stationary culture in the sense that the concentration of the organisms in the culture is not changing. But alternatively, it's not a stationary phase where organisms are not growing. Instead, what it is essentially an ongoing log or exponential phase where there's ongoing replication. So stationary phase here represents replication that's balanced by loss rather than an absence of replication altogether. Though a steady state and technically a stationary phase, this circumstance is nonetheless quite log phase-like in that the organisms are ongoing in their replication. They're replicating at a constant rate. It's just that the increase in cell number is being balanced by the loss of cells from the environment. This kind of situation is a much simpler selective scheme. It's basically selecting on the rate at which the organisms can increase their numbers in the environment that they're found in. Under the environmental conditions that they're found in. And such a situation contrasts with the complexity that you can see with serial transfer experiments. So even if the transfer is just occurring within a test tube or flask environment, you still can have passage from lag phase to log phase to stationary phase. Although it's also possible with serial transfer experiments, although it takes a bit more effort to do this, to keep the organisms in log phase. In this case, you would be placing log phase cells into fresh broth. They would grow up, but not to the point where they've exited log phase. You would take another transfer, initiate that growth again, take another transfer, initiate that growth again. So it's possible to keep cells in log phase or continuously growing also if you're doing serial transfer. It just takes more effort. On the other hand, when you're doing these kinds of experiments using serial transfer rather than using a continuous culture, then you can once again control what the experiment looks like better. Under continuous culture in log in chemistats, you have a balance between the bacterial growth and the bacterial loss, or the organism growth and the organism loss. But the actual rate of growth is going to be limited by the organisms growing at the point where they're also removing nutrients from their environment as fast as those nutrients are replenished. Whereas with serial transfer experiments, you don't have those kinds of limitations. So again, it tends to be, once you set things up, easier to have a continuous culture experiment, but you typically can control what's going on in the experiments to a much greater degree when you do serial transfer. You can, for example, drop the stationary phase organisms into fresh broth and let them go through the log phase, the stationary phase, and back again. You can have the organisms being transferred during their log phase only. You can grow cultures on solid media and do transfers. You can grow cultures in animals or in plants or other kinds of complex environments and do transfers. And all of these will reflect removing organisms from one of these phases, or alternatively, even removing organisms from multiple phases at any given time during each of your transfers. So I guess the bottom line is that when you're doing serial transfer, things can be much more complex than what you see with continuous cultures. Although with continuous cultures, things are simple enough that we can understand the theory a bit, and that makes them a little bit complicated too. So this is a continuous culture device. This is a chemistat. A chemistat is relatively simple. It basically represents an ideal small pond, where you've got an inflow into the pond, you've got stuff going on in the pond, ideally you've got some mixing going on there, and then you have outflow from the pond into a stream, over a dam, what have you. So you've got the inflow coming from a reservoir, and here the reservoir is a broth medium, and it has nutrients in it. Even if you've got an oligotrophic pond, you still have some kinds of nutrients coming in from whatever stream or spring is feeding that pond. But typically, you use richer media when you're doing chemistats than you would see in a pond. Otherwise, your experiments would take forever. I should say an oligotrophic pond. Otherwise, your experiments would take forever. So you've got this reservoir of medium, and it's coming into the growth chamber, which is essentially your pond. You can control the rate at which it comes in. It can be gravity fed, or it can be peristaltic pump fed, etc. You have mixing inside the growth chamber because you have, for example, a stir bar there, or you're shaking, but usually shaking would make things a little complicated. So you've got stir bars, and then you have outflow. Outflow is gravity fed, and so as a consequence, you are losing the media as fast, spent media as fast as the fresh media is coming in. If the organisms need aeration, you can have air here. You've got an opening into the chambers that you can sample the organisms or add things such as organisms to the chamber. So the chemistats are a means of keeping the culture in a growth phase indefinitely. So you can think of this as a stationary phase or a log phase. It's a stationary phase in the sense that the culture's concentrations, once the steady state has been established, are not changing. It's a log phase in the sense that the organisms are continually growing. This is where the media, the fresh media, comes from. Typically, you'll have a medium that consists of single limiting nutrient, but an excess of nutrients otherwise. This is fed into the growth chamber at a constant rate. This is where the growth actually takes place. You have the inflow rate being balanced by the outflow rate, simply because the outflow is gravity driven. So as the level rises here, it pushes media out, so the level stays more or less the same. The volume of the cultures stay the same. Fresh media comes in, spent media comes out, and also coming out of whatever organisms are found in here, as well as any nutrients that are left over in there. And this media that comes out can be placed in a collection vessel. Alternatively, it can just be placed and sampled as it comes out. Alternatively, it can be simply placed in a waste vessel that then gets, for example, autoclaved. So this is just a close-up on the growth chamber. The growth vessel is well stirred, and all other significant parameters such as temperatures affecting growth are kept constant. So this is a chemostat, stat meaning stationary. It's stationary in the sense that the cell cultures are kept at a constant density. Doesn't mean they're not growing, but it means that you have a steady state, but it's definitely stationary in terms of their concentration. It's also stationary in terms of the concentration of nutrients and wastes that are found in the environment. And the constant parameter values are present as a consequence of a constant rate of inflow balanced by a constant rate of outflow. And the organisms that are in here are basically growing as fast as they can and using up nutrients at a constant rate, and also generating waste at a constant rate. So now we can turn to basic chemostat theory. Again, chemostats, although they can be relatively difficult to set up in comparison to serial transfer experiments, chemostats actually are simpler systems. All you have are organisms that just keep growing and growing and growing, using up nutrients at a constant rate, generating waste at a constant rate, being lost from the environment at a constant rate, with inflow at a constant rate, et cetera, et cetera. And as a consequence of this simplicity, it's possible to model chemostats and therefore understand what's going on in chemostats mathematically to a fairly decent extent. And so we're going to talk about basic chemostat theory, and then we're going to eventually in this lecture use this theory to understand competition as it can occur within a chemostat. So within the culture vessel, what you have going on is you have nutrients. And you can define the rate of change of nutrients as equal to the nutrients that are input into the culture, the nutrients that are lost from the culture, and the consumption of those nutrients by organisms. So input subtracted by washout, subtracted by what's lost due to consumption. You also have cells potentially changing. I say prey here because if we've got a three trophic level chemostat, which we'll talk about, you might have something eating these cells. But these cells often will be bacterial cells. They are able to divide, so this gives rise to births, that is new cells. Just like nutrients, cells can wash out of the chemostat growth chamber, and it's also possible for cells to die. Now, cells can die if they're being predated upon, but they can die by other reasons. So you have the new cells that come into the system via births, replication of the cells, binary fission for bacteria. Subtracted from that is the cell loss due to washout, outflow from the chemostat growth chamber, and then subtracted from that are any deaths of cells. And then you can have, if you have a three trophic level chemostat, you can have predators of these cells as well. Their rate of change also can be defined in terms of births. So as they consume cells, they make new copies of themselves. Also, the predators will wash out, and also the predators may be subject to a death that's independent of this washout. So again, births minus washout minus deaths, but births of the predators minus washout of the predators minus deaths of the predators. You can use the word growth instead of births if you like. People often use the word births, but of course births has a more specific meaning that may not be applicable to viruses or bacteria, but this is basically replication of these organisms, the making of babies, or at least the making of new individuals. Deaths does not necessarily occur within these systems, and often the deaths component can be ignored. The effect of washout, however, is essentially identical to the effect of death. So far as the growth chamber is concerned, what you have is a loss of viable organisms from the growth chamber, whether it's via washout or death within the growth chamber. For the nutrients, we could actually substitute the word births for input. Of course, the births are a consequence of this inflow, but nonetheless, it's basically an increase in the number of individuals. And if we wanted to, we could substitute the word deaths for consumption, because this is a loss of the nutrients within the growth chamber itself, rather than the nutrients being washed out. So each of these expressions could be births minus washout minus deaths. Note that the births of predators often come at the expense of the cells that are serving as prey. And so, as I noted, a component of the deaths of prey can be at the hands, figuratively speaking, of the predators. And also keep in mind that when we start introducing predators into this system, things get exciting really fast, which means they get pretty darn complicated very fast. We'll be concentrating mostly on systems that don't have predators, but instead just have cells. This is a two trophic system. The two trophic levels are the nutrients and the cells that are eating those nutrients. In a three trophic level system, you have nutrients that are eaten by something, and with that something, in this case the cells, in turn being eaten by the predators. So here we have a typical two trophic level chemostat. You have something that is growing, and it is growing at the expense of some medium that is found in the environment. This turns out to be a yeast that is growing here. But you can see simple dynamics, growth dynamics. You've got maybe a lag phase here when you first added the yeast. They go through an actual log phase where they're increasing in number in the environment. And then you have a stationary phase, except this is a chemostat. So the stationary phase represents a balance between the replication of these organisms and their loss from the environment, rather than a cessation of replication of the organisms. And this, just by example, is a three trophic level chemostat. The bacteria, which are shown here, are consuming at the expense of some nutrients in the broth that they're found in this case, glucose and inorganic nutrients. And this is E. coli, actually. And what you've got here are the phages that are growing at the expense of the bacteria. In fact, as the bacteriophages increase in numbers, it's done in association with the bacteria decreasing in numbers. And if the phage concentration here gets too high, it actually drives the bacteria to extinction. So much more complicated with these one, two, and then the nutrients three level of trophic level systems. Though still modelable, but not necessarily modelable with great precision. So when you're doing either your two trophic level or three trophic level chemostats, it is helpful to be able to keep track of the growth rate of the cells. So this would be the second trophic level. These are the things that are growing at the expense of the nutrients in the environment. So exploitative competition or competitive exclusion occurs because cell growth declines as a function of substrate that is limiting resource density. So as the cell number increases, the use of nutrients by those cells increases. This results in a decline in nutrients in the environment. And as a consequence of that, we have an expectation that the cells will decline in their rate of replication. And the question is, how do you capture that mathematically? And the answer is the Minot model, or at least that's one of the answers. It's one of the simpler of the answers. So a typical means of modeling this decline in cell growth is via the Minot model. And this is based essentially on the Michaelis-Menten enzyme saturation equation. And that's the Minot model or the Michaelis-Menten equation. And what you have here is the rate of growth of the cells is equal to the maximum rate of growth of the cells. That's when substrate densities are not limiting. S is the nutrient or substrate density. And K sub S is the 1/2 maximal growth rate. It's the concentration of substrate at which the organisms are capable of growing at 1/2 their maximal rate. So this is their maximal rate. If you divided this by 2, the substrate density at which that would occur would be equal to this K sub S. So all of this is in substrate units, So they collapse down to just a non-dimensional unit. Mathematicians, help me out here. Basically, a number that doesn't have any units associated with it. So the result is that this is equal to between 0 and 1, and it's 0 if the substrate density is 0, and it's 1 if the substrate density is very large in comparison to the K sub s constant. And so if you multiply 0 times u max, then you end up with 0 growth. If you multiply 1 times u max, meaning that the substrate density is not limiting, you end up with the growth rate of the organisms being the maximum. And then if you have substrate density in the range of this K sub s parameter, then the K sub s parameter substantially impacts this ratio here, and you end up with a growth rate that is equal to u max reduced by some amount that's a function of substrate density. So, for example, if the substrate density were equal to K sub s, then you'd have K sub s plus K sub s down here, or 2K sub s, and up here you would have K sub s. So K sub s divided by 2K sub s is 1/2, and the growth rate where the substrate density is equal to K sub s is in fact 1/2 the maximum growth rate, which is basically how K sub s is defined. So it's good that that all works out. By the way, in terms of exams, I'm not going to be testing on the mathematics, but it's helpful to have some sense of what's going on mathematically. So the Michaelis-Menten equation, the Monod equation, gives rise to these saturation kinetics, where at very low substrate density, here's our S, you essentially reduce the rate of either replication or the enzyme. The rate of enzyme, the rate of catalysis to 0. Whereas when you increase the substrate density sufficiently, what you end up with is a rate that's essentially the maximum rate. And here is K sub s. So K sub s is in substrate units, and it represents the substrate density that corresponds to the 1/2, whoops, whoops, that corresponds to the 1/2 the growth rate of the organism. So that's maximum, that's 1/2 maximum, that's 0, and whatever substrate density corresponds to this 1/2 maximum, that's our K sub s term. So this is the 1/2 the growth rate, but the K sub s itself is in substrate units. And this is our saturation. So as substrate density becomes higher and higher and higher, you approach this maximum growth rate. The essence of what goes on during the serial passage or the continuous culturing of an organism, particularly if you have sufficiently large concentrations of these organisms, is competition and adaptation that's associated with that competition. And so we're going to switch gears slightly here and talk about competition itself. So there's a number of different ways that competition can occur. One is competition as it occurs within populations, which is intraspecific competition. So the size of a population limits how fast a population grows, and therefore you have what are known as density-dependent effects. In other words, individuals making up the same species are competing for the same resources. The more individuals you have present, that is, the higher their density, then the faster these resources will be used up, the more limiting they'll be. And what you have is competition within these populations, within these species, over these resources, and the individuals that are more effective in utilizing those resources are going to be the better competitors, or are the better competitors. And these better competitors will tend to increase in frequency within the population. Now, there's also inter-specific competition. In inter-specific competition, you also have density-dependent effects. So the size of one species in a community, remember a community is a is basically an ecosystem consisting of more than one species, just considering the biotic component, so just considering the species, it's more than one species. So population size of one species in a community limits the population size of another species. So with intraspecific competition, everybody is the same species, so the density of the species affects the ability of the individuals within that population to replicate. With interspecific competition, the size of a different species population, its density, can affect the ability of individuals within the second species to replicate. Of course, the ability of the individuals in the first species will in turn potentially be affected by the size of the population of the second species. These can be described as negative-negative interactions because when you have interspecific competition going on, in a sense, everybody loses because there's fewer resources available to both populations because both populations are competing over the same resources. Now, an aspect of interspecific competition, but you can also consider it in terms of intraspecific competition in some circumstances, is something known as exploitative competition. So in exploitative competition, you're competing over resources. You're not competing directly, but the utilization of resources by one species has the effect of eliminating those resources from access by the other species. So species A removes resources from the environment, and population growth of species B is therefore reduced because there are fewer resources. And as above, when we said that species A is affecting species B, similarly, species B can affect species A. Now, the extent of the magnitude of the degree to which species A affects species B is going to be dependent upon the size of these populations. If species A and species B are not present in high densities, then there's going to be little or no exploitative competition going on. If species A is at its carrying capacity and species B is not present in high densities, then species A will be having a large impact on species B, but not vice versa. If species B is at its carrying capacity and species A is low in density, then species B will be impacting species A, but not species A on B, just because the densities of species A will be too small. If both species A and species B are present at high numbers, however, they'll be having a substantial impact on whatever resources they utilize, and as a consequence, they'll be having impacts on both on each other. So species A will be impacting species B and species B, species A. So again, densities, population sizes are really important in determining the degree to which competition is going on between two species. The simplest form of competition occurs when two or more populations compete for the same resource, such as a common food supply or a growth-limiting nutrient, and this is called exploitative competition. And then you have the concept of competitive exclusion. Again, this is something that's typically described in terms of two species, interspecific competition, but it has some applicability to intraspecific competition, such as when you have clonal organisms competing. So the competitive exclusion principle states that no two species can coexist if they have the same niche. Competition will cause one of the species to exclude the other. And it's exploitative competition typically that is driving competitive exclusion, and both of these are examples of interspecific competition. So now we can start looking at each of these individually. So exploitative competition first, species A removes resources from the environment, and population growth of species B is reduced as a consequence. So we can see this potentially going on here. And what we have presumably are two individual organisms. They actually appear to be the same species. They appear to be different strains of the same organism. And they are, I say, presumably competing over the same limiting resources. That's not necessarily the case. But if indeed they have niches that basically completely overlap, then when they're present at these high densities, they are causing each other to display a lower level of population growth because the amount of resources available to both of these species is going to be declined because of the presence of the other species. You can see here that we've got growth of this species. It's actually going a little bit beyond its carrying capacity, and in fact it seems to be dropping down substantially below what presumably is its carrying capacity. And here you have another, this other species, which also seems to be exceeding its carrying capacity, but not dropping down as much below the dashed line as this species is. The dashed lines are theoretical curves, the solid lines are actual curves. So here you have competition between these two species, presumably for the same resources. Dashed lines are theoretical curves, and this individual appears to not be very effective at maintaining its densities near its steady state. Now keep in mind, that would be its carrying capacity, keep in mind that these again are chemostats. And so what we're looking at here at these stationary phases is not an absence of growth, but instead a balance between the rate of growth occurring in the growth chamber and the loss of cells from that growth chamber. Essentially a balance between births and washout. So that was competition. Exploitative competition is competition over resources. You end up with lower densities of the two organisms as a consequence at their carrying capacities. And in fact, probably a reason why these individuals are dropping down below their carrying capacity is because of the presence of the other. So here, this individual actually is pretty much matching its carrying capacity until the density of these individuals increases sufficiently that presumably some degree of competition is going on. And when these individuals decline in density, it has the effect of reversing the impact on these guys. So it's at carrying capacity, it's at the steady state for a chemostat that you see the most, that competition is strongest and most visible. So at any rate, going back to intra-specific competition, so the size of a population is limited because the population growth rates are a function of nutrient or resource concentrations, which in turn are affected negatively by population density. So the higher the population size or density, the lower the number of nutrients, and therefore the more slowly the organisms replicate. So this is a population growing in which there are no density-dependent effects or no noticeable ones. You have exponential growth going on here, and so the population is essentially growing at a constant rate. It's doubling per some unit time, and that doubling time is staying constant. And this is because nutrients aren't limiting. So this indicates an absence of competition for resources. And this is at least supposed to be an exponential curve. So interspecific competition is actually what we're not seeing when we're looking at an exponential curve like the previous slide showed. So this is in fact an exponential increase, or at least it's an approximation of an exponential increase, especially down low here. So what we have here are numbers of organisms, and that's time again. Intraspecific competition is what you're seeing when you have density-dependent effects, and density-dependent effects, not surprisingly, you don't really see until the densities of the organisms are fairly high, and that's what's being seen in this part of the curve. So this is a logistic growth curve, and what we're seeing is exponential growth, or at least an approximation of it, and then increasing density-dependent effects that cause the population growth rate to slow, and in fact to reach a point where there's a steady state, where there's a balance between the rate of births and the rate of deaths within the population. This steady state here is the environment's carrying capacity, and in the steepness of this curve here, the rate at which it you have an increase in the population size is a function of the individual organism growth rates under the conditions that this environmental conditions that this a population growth is occurring in. So you're getting these density dependent effects up here in the curve. Ultimately, they're reflected in the population, either assuming its carrying capacity or exceeding it and then crashing to below its carrying capacity. This is logistic growth, growth without limits, which is what you're seeing here, is followed by growth with limits. The limits become increasing as the population densities increase until the limits are, in fact, maximal at carrying capacity, at the point where the population growth rate is essentially zero. The populations are not changing in density over time. So the carrying capacity up here, it defines environmental limits, resource limitations on population growth. It's a characteristic of the environment in which this is taking place in, the growth is taking place in. And you're getting competition for resources in here. And because this is a single species, a single population, what we're looking at here is intraspecific competition. So next we can look at interspecific competition. So with interspecific competition, both of the species are displaying the same kind of curve, logistic curve. Here's K, which is our carrying capacity. But when you have another species present that's competing for the same limiting resources, the result is that you have fewer resources available as a consequence of the actions of this other species, and that can have the effect of reducing the carrying capacity of an environment for a given organism. And that's what's being shown here, where you've got these arrows pointing down, the curve is being dropped down to a lower level. The maximum concentrations that this species can sustain within this environment over time is lower in the presence of a competitor than it is in the absence of a competitor. And this is the consequence of interspecific competition. The same thing may very well be happening for the competitor species. It's a negative-negative interaction. Both species lose from this competition because basically neither of them has many resources available to them as they would have if the other species, the competitor species, were not present. So then we can look again at competitive exclusion. So we've got two species growing alone. They have a population densities that are different, but they're the characteristic population densities at carrying capacity for each of the species. You start growing these two species together, however, and at the point where resources start become limiting, one of these species, if niches overlap sufficiently, one of these species is going to be a better competitor of the other, and the better competitor is going to drive the other species to extinction, and this process is known as competitive exclusion. So competitive exclusion is going on here. And as I've said previously, the competitive exclusion is more likely to be occurring near to carrying capacity rather than when the densities of the organisms are relatively low, because really this is a density-dependent phenomenon. You have two organisms that at higher densities, the amount of resources available to both is lower, and it's that organism that's more effective in gathering and utilizing those resources that are available that's going to be the better competitor. Competition is clearly important in nature. When one population increases in size, the growth rate of the others should diminish or at least not increase. So this diminishment is a consequence of interspecific competition, and if it results in declines and extinction of one of the species, then it's known as competitive exclusion. So this is an example of competitive exclusion. Once again, we have a chemistat. We've got these two individuals. Their growth rates are the same. They're starting out at different concentrations, but their growth rates are the same. This one is overshooting its carrying capacity more than this one is overshooting its carrying capacity. But once this individual starts reaching carrying capacity at steady state, its ability to reduce resource densities are sufficient to cause a crash in the presence of this competitor and a loss of it from the system. So this is competitive exclusion. These two individuals apparently do not seem to be able to occupy this chemistat simultaneously. This individual is the better competitor in driving that individual to extinction. Once again, the dashed lines are the theoretical curves. So these two have similar intrinsic growth rates, but this individual seems to have a lower competitive ability than that individual. This species also seems to be relatively good at holding itself at its carrying capacity. Again, the dashed line is the theoretical curve. Presumably, and we'll get to why this is so, presumably this organism has a larger K sub est term, a half maximal constant, than this individual does. In other words, presumably this individual has a lower affinity for the whatever resources are limiting in this chemistat than that individual does. So even though they grow at the same rate, this individual is able to gather up resources more effectively than that individual is, and as a consequence, lowers the overall amount of resources in the environment. But at those lower levels of resources, because of the greater resource affinity, these guys are still able to replace themselves, whereas at the lower level of resources, these guys are driven to extinction because they simply their affinity for the resource is lower than the affinity of the better competitor. And we'll get to what that all means. So who's the better competitor? In a chemistat, we can actually figure this out, or at least we can provide some theory to determining who should be the better competitor in a given chemistat. So you've got two individuals in a chemistat. They're competing against each other. Which one of them is going to drive the other one to extinction, or indeed are either going to drive the other to extinction? So what we've got here is an equation. Once again, it's an equation that I'm not going to be holding you responsible for, but understanding what's going on there wouldn't be such a bad thing. So the resource density at which a population neither increases nor decreases is defined as this S asterisk or S star. So what we've got here is S star, which or S asterisk, which is this resource density, is equal to the dilution rate times K sub S, which we've seen before, divided by U max, the maximum population growth rate for an organism, again, subtracted by dilution rate. So U max is the max growth rate, K sub S is the half maximal constant, and this is a measure of substrate affinity. Basically, the larger this is, the lower the substrate affinity that an organism has for its substrate. D is the chemistat dilution rate, and S star is a substrate density. So it's those organisms for which this value is lowest that are expected to be the better competitors within a chemistat. Evolution will favor those organisms that minimize S star, and this occurs if you maximize your maximal growth rate. So the bigger this is, because it's in the denominator, the smaller that will be. Or if you decrease your one-half maximal resource density. So K sub S is up here in the numerator, so the smaller this is, the smaller this will be. So this is saying that because as you decrease K sub S, you're increasing affinity for substrate. It's saying as you that increasing affinity for substrate or increasing rate of population growth, maximal rate of population growth, both of those will have the effect of reducing S star and therefore increasing the competitive ability of an organism. Evolution will also favor novel strategies such as antagonistic behavior, bacteriocins or prophages, or mechanisms for reducing for resisting outflow, such as displaying wall populations. But these ideas are not found within this equation. Instead, what this equation looks at is simply these two parameters associated with an organism: how fast it's capable of growing, and what its affinity is for substrate. So this is a description of the lowest substrate concentration at which an organism is capable of replicating. It will vary as a function of the dilution rate of the environment. And as this value decreases, the competitive ability increases. That's hence the curve that looks like that. So the lower the substrate density at which an organism is still able to replace itself within a chemostat, then the greater the competitive ability that organism will have in that chemostat. And why is that? Because as you lower the substrate density, at some point you're going to lower it to the point where the organism is no longer able to replace itself. It's not going to have enough food to replace itself. If an organism can go lower, if one organism can go lower than another organism, then the organism that can go lower can reduce, it can still be replicating at a substrate density that the other organism is no longer able to replicate at. Therefore, this other organism will go extinct within the environment. What this all means is that the more that an organism can do with less, then the greater its competitive ability. So the better it's able to replicate, even given very low concentrations, then the better its competitive ability in a chemostat at carrying capacity. Of course, it doesn't describe its competitive ability necessarily in all situations, but when you're in a chemostat and you have reduced the nutrient level to the point where it's just being replaced at the point of inflow of new broth, that's going to be a minimal nutrient density, and if the organism can still grow at that density, then it retains itself in the chemostat. If it can no longer replace itself at that density, then it goes extinct. So S star is smaller the faster an organism can grow, or the higher its affinity for substrate. And faster an organism can grow would be the theoretical maximum rate of its growth. And this is because the bigger this number is, the smaller S star is, the smaller that number is, the smaller S star is. The smaller that number is, the higher the affinity an organism has for its substrate. So just to remind you again about what Umax is and what K sub S is. So Umax is the maximum growth rate that you will see for an organism that is not limited by its substrate. And K sub S is the substrate density at which half maximal growth is observed. As K sub S becomes smaller, it means that the half maximal substrate density is lower. And in order for an organism to continue replicating at half its maximal rate at lower substrate density, it's going to have to be able to gather up that substrate just as well as it could when the substrate density was higher, or if the substrate density were higher, and that means it needs to have a greater affinity for that substrate. So S star is smaller as this quantity becomes smaller, and as this quantity becomes smaller, it simply means that the organism is able to do more with less. It's able to replicate at a half maximal rate using less substrate than an organism that has a greater KS. If you had a mutation in an organism that reduced its KS, that means it would be maintaining its growth rate but doing so at lower substrate densities. Alternatively, you have a mutation that increased the KS, it means that it requires higher substrate densities to continue doing the same thing, growing at half maximal. So increases in KS would be a mutation that gave rise to an increase in KS would be seen as a detrimental mutation, all else held constant. And a mutation that had the effect of decreasing KS would be seen as a beneficial mutation, all else held constant. And so here we're seeing again the equation where we've got S star is equal to dilution rate times KS. Smaller KS is, smaller S star is, divided by Umax minus the dilution rate. The higher Umax is, the smaller S star is. So here we've got two populations that are competing with one another. One has a higher Umax. and the other has a lower mu max. And if these guys have the same KS value, it doesn't matter. The S star for this will be lower than for this, because this individual has a higher mu max. So going back, so if the individuals have the same KS, but one of them has a larger mu max, then S star will be smaller for the larger mu max, and that will be the better competitor. So if these guys have the same KS, if this guy has a higher U max, which is what the steeper curve is indicating, then it should be the better competitor. So the species that keeps increasing its population sizes at lower resource densities is the one that's going to win this competition. This individual keeps increasing its population sizes even as nutrient densities are presumably declining, because the density of organisms is increasing. Oops. Whether a microorganism can stay in a chemostat is mostly dependent upon its specific growth rate and its substrate affinity. Microorganisms of low growth rate will be washed out when the chemostat is operated at a high dilution rate. And low growth rate organisms will also be washed out if that growth rate is low growth rate is a consequence of being deprived of nutrients, is what we're seeing here. When the concentration of a certain substrate is kept in a low region, a microorganism which has a lower substrate affinity will not be able to live, grow when a rival of higher substrate affinity coexists. This is actually not what we're seeing here. What we're seeing here is at an absolute minimum a higher mu max that's giving these guys an advantage. We actually don't know about substrate affinity. And what we're seeing here is two organisms where this one actually displays a higher mu max than this one does. So it's got a steeper line here. But once we get up to carrying capacity, it seems to decline in the presence of this one. So what does that mean? Since this one has a higher mu max, it can't be because it has a lower mu max. So therefore, it's presumably because it has a larger KS, a case of S, and as a consequence, it's sufficiently high to make up for the fact that it has a larger mu max. And so this individual is outcompeting this one, presumably as a consequence of this one having a higher affinity for it, the nutrients that they're competing over than that one has. So lower intrinsic growth rate, but similar competitive ability suggests that it has a lower case of S. So if you have a lower intrinsic growth rate, you've got to make up for that by having a lower case of S. And that's why we're predicting that this individual here has a lower case of S, because we can see that it has a lower mu max. Now, it's possible to get fancy with our continuous cultures. With a turbidostat, what we have is the equivalent of a chemostat, except rather than the rate of inflow and outflow being just constant over time. Instead, there is a sensor that keeps track of the turbidity of this environment. And the turbidity is a measure of the amount of organisms that are there. And the turbidity of the environment, as it increases because of cell growth, then we have a dropping of fresh media in and a loss of spent media along with cells until it brings the turbidity back down to some preset level. So this also, it's a stat in the sense that things are being kept constant. It's just that a little bit more effort is going into keeping the concentrations constant. And with this effort, you can modify things more effectively than you can in the chemostat, because you don't have the chemostat just displaying explicitly what it is able to display based upon flow rates as well as the organism properties. Instead, you can actually modify where how much flow comes in and when in order to keep your population density at some constant rate. So there's a little bit more manipulability with the turbostat than with the chemostat. You can also take these turbidostats and you can use them to create what are known as two-stage chemostats. So in a two-stage chemostat, for example, in the first stage you'll have, say, bacteria, and the second stage you'll have, for example, bacteriophages. And because this is a turbidostat, you can control the concentration of the bacteria that are flowing into the second growth chamber here, and the concentration of bacteria coming into the second growth chamber supplies a more or less constant amount of bacteria for the phages, which are only found in the second growth chamber, and they're growing like crazy. And that can give you, for the phages, a constant growth rate. Recall previously when we had our three trophic level chemostat, what we had was all sorts of instability. The phages were going up, the bacteria went down. In a sense, what this creates is a two trophic level chemostat that just consists of the bacteria and the phages. This is also a two trophic level chemostat, but this is the trophic level that has the nutrients for the bacteria, and this is the trophic level that has the bacteria as nutrients for the phages. And so as a consequence, you can have constant phage growth in this growth chamber because the bacterial densities really are not as much a function of what's going on in this growth chamber as they are if you have a three trophic level chemostat, where in fact bacterial levels are affected by phage levels and things bounce up and down like crazy. So this is just a way, it's more complicated, but it's a way of achieving essentially a two trophic level chemostat even when you've got a predator and prey present.